The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And this morning, we are going to revisit an interview I did in 1995 with the late Janet Leigh. She had a book out at the time called Psycho, Behind the Scenes of the Classic Thriller. And 1995 was a really fun year for me on the program because over the course of a month, I had two very famous movie stars as guests. The first was the late Charlton Heston. A month later, I talked to Janet Leigh, and they made a famous film together, and during this interview we talked about that. Janet Leigh was born on July 6, 1927. Her birth name was Jeanette Helen Morrison. She was an actress, singer, dancer, and author. She was raised in Stockton, California. And according to Wikipedia, she was discovered at age 18 by the actress Norma Shearer, who helped her secure a contract with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Leigh had her first formal foray into acting, appearing in radio shows, before making her film debut in 1947 in The Romance of Rosie Ridge. Early on in her career, she appeared in several popular films for MGM, and they spanned a variety of genres, including the 1948 film Act of Violence, in 1949 Little Women, in 1951 Angels in the Outfield, in 1952 Scaramouche. And she also starred in Safari in 1956 and in 1958. The Orson Welles film noir, Touch of Evil. But her most famous portrayal was as the doomed Marion Crane in Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho in 1960. Here's Janet Leigh from The Best of the Book Nook.
Three of the films that the L.A. Times mention as among the 50 greatest films, and you were in all three of those, Psycho, The Manchurian Candidate, and Touch of Evil.
Pretty lucky, right?
I'll say. And you've been very busy. You have a couple of books out. You just put out House of Destiny, which is that your first novel?
That's my first novel. That has been in the process of being written for the last few years. After I wrote my autobiography, There Really Was a Hollywood, I liked writing, and so I had an idea for a novel, and I started in, and I did it my own time, you know, because I do wear a lot of hats, and whenever I had a chance, I would put on the writer's hat. And and I finished the first draft of the novel when they approached me about the book on the making of the film Psycho. And during the writing and research of that, the novel sold, House of Destiny sold, and that's why they're both out the same year.
The book Psycho, Behind the Scenes of the Classic Thriller, came out this spring with Christopher Nickens.
Right, it was in time for the 35th anniversary of the release of the film.
I just finished the book last night, and it was an amazing book. I was just enthralled by some of the little tidbits that you put in that book.
Oh, good. Good.
It seems to me that from some of the photos that Alfred Hitchcock really seems like a friendly, outgoing guy. He's smiling.
Okay. I beg your pardon?
He's smiling and just seems like a wonderful fellow in the photos.
Absolutely. That was one of the misconceptions that I had hoped to set straight, because I think people had this image of a rather forbidding, imposing figure, and he was, by contrast, he was pleasant and, you know, calm and comfortable and enjoyable, because he didn't have the need to be frenetic because his work was done. You know, when he started shooting the picture, the preliminary and the planning had all been done. So he could sit back and relax. All he had to do was transfer his images that he already had written down in his script to the screen.
My guest in the Book Nook is the author and actress Janet Leigh. You were discovered by Norma Shearer. Can you tell us about that?
I sure can. It's the same kind of miracle as having two books out the same year. I mean, the odds are just about the same. Because I was visiting my parents who were working at a ski lodge in Northern California, and they took a picture, a little, you know, snapshot, and Norma Shearer and her husband Marty Arroje spent the month of February at this particular lodge, and they saw the picture, brought it back to Hollywood, gave it to Lou Wasserman, who was head of MCA Talent Agency, who gave it to the new talent department, who contacted Jeanette Helen Morrison, who had come to Los Angeles for a completely different reason, then took me to MGM, where I signed a contract the next day. I mean, it was, you know, and then another miracle on top of the first one was that the talent, the drama coach, Lillian Byrne-Sidney, saw something in doing a scene with me that sparked her to call the director and producer of a movie they were making called Romance of Rosie Ridge opposite Van Johnson. And I was right for the part. They tested me. And I, you know, 2 weeks after that, I was doing a lead opposite Van Johnson. I mean, it was, as I said, it was one miracle after another.
That's really an incredible story.
Oh, I know it. People always said, I mean, the PR department at MGM, once I was signed to do the picture, first the contract, but then to actually be in this picture, they sent for me and they had to find out who this person was, you know, who Jeanette Helen Morrison Reams was. And they said, that's a great story, but you better tell us how it really happened so that we can protect you. And I, you know, they didn't believe it was true.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Recently, last month, Charlton Heston was on this program. He has a new autobiography out, and he mentioned the film Touch of Evil with Orson Welles, which you appeared in also as a film that really had an impact on him.
Because of Welles, you mean?
Because of working with Orson Welles.
Right.
What was it like to work with Orson?
Well, it was a very unique, complete experience. As I'm sure that Charlton mentioned, even though he could plan, like Mr. Hitchcock did, the opening shot obviously had to be very well planned. It was, you know, very intricate and exacting and, you know, and innovative at that time. So that was definitely planned. But he was of the mind that, like, we'd be shooting a scene, and he'd look, and he'd see, an oil derrick, say, against this moonlit sky and shadows and trees or whatever, and he'd say, oh, that's a great background. I'm going to write a scene to do right here. And so he would improvise something to do using that background that he had just seen. I mean, that's how his mind worked.
That's amazing.
Yes, it was... obviously stimulating and always, you know, kept you on your toes.
Obviously, films like The Manchurian Candidate and Psycho are some of the better-known films that you've appeared in, but you have made a tremendous number of films. How many?
Over 50 films, and then maybe 35 or something like TV movies, you know. And some of those TV movies were doggone good. You know, the ones made for TV. I did it like House on Green Apple Road. I thought that was an excellent movie. It was also called Red Kitchen Murders. And that was really good. And Mirror, Mirror, I thought, you know, some of these, some of the movies that were made for TV were, I thought, exceptionally well done.
Television movies as well as cinema has really changed over the years. Psycho was a film that didn't really show violence, it implied it. And it seemed
to. Exactly right.
It opened the floodgates for more violent films.
No, Psycho didn't open the floodgate.
But people were trying to imitate it.
Well, the floodgate was opened when they took off the restrictions.
Ah, the censorship?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, the violence was implied in Psycho, beautifully implied. I mean, you know, the craftsmanship and the planning, the building, the orchestrating, which led to climax. The frenzy was created by implication and then created in the viewer's mind because we could not show violence. When they took the limitations off, when they took the censorship away, you could show anything, say anything, do anything. There was no need for that kind of planning, and they just showed any kind of violence you wanted, any kind of nudity you wanted, any kind of sex you wanted. And it just took away the mystery and the imagination.
And the masterful musical score by Bernard Herrmann really creates...
That was just, you know, that was brilliant.
Amazing suspense.
Yes, absolutely. And that, with the editing and the score... that's why, you know, the impact of the shower scene was so strong.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and today bringing you my 1995 interview with Janet Lee. We were talking about her book Psycho, behind the scenes of the classic thriller. And at the time, she was headed to Dayton for a event about her. It was a Janet Lee Film Festival, and that was held in Dayton in 1995. So I was able to get an interview with her. And I recorded this on the telephone. I called her at a very nice hotel she was staying in New York City called the Hotel Pierre. And when I arranged the interview, they said, call the front desk and ask for Mrs. Robert Brandt. And I did. And she picked up the phone. And we had a delightful conversation. We'll continue with the Best of the Book Nook right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO today, bringing you my 1995 interview with the late Janet Lee. She was coming through Dayton for a film festival in her honor at the time, and she had a book out called Psycho, Behind the Scenes of the Classic Thriller. That movie came out in 1960, and wow, what a movie. Do you remember the first time you saw Psycho? In 1960, she was cast in what is her most well-known role in that film, as the morally ambiguous murder victim Marion Crane, co-starring with John Gavin and Anthony Perkins. According to Wikipedia, she was reportedly so traumatized by filming her character's shower murder scene that she went to great lengths to avoid showers for the rest of her life. For that performance, she received a Golden Globe Award for Best Supporting Actress and was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress. Her role in Psycho became career-defining, and she later commented, quote, I've been in a great many films, but I suppose if an actor can be remembered for one role, then they're very fortunate. And in that sense, I'm fortunate. Her character's death early in the film has been noted as historically relevant by film scholars, as it violated narrative conventions of the time. While her murder scene itself is considered among both critics and film scholars to be one of the most iconic scenes in film history. A month before I interviewed Janet Lee, I interviewed another actor, the late Charlton Heston. He was coming through Dayton on book tour. And during that interview, he said that the chariot race scene that he starred in the film Ben-Hur, was the greatest moment in the history of cinematography. He actually said that. Let's continue now with my 1995 interview with Janet Leigh.
I also discovered in reading the book that Mr. Hitchcock liked to create rumors about Psycho. He kept the set very private, and he liked to have rumors going out to build the excitement in the film, whether they were true or not.
Oh, sure. I mean, that was part of the, you know, it was like, what's going on in that crazy set? And so that the all the mystery surrounding it and the fact that you couldn't go in once it had started was unheard of at that time. But today, of course, it's hard for them to for people to understand that at the time that Psycho was released, that was the first picture that, unless it was a road show or something, but I mean, you know, the first regular release where you couldn't go in any time and you'd see the where you went in and then you'd see the next double feature and then you'd see the picture to, you know, at the first part to where you came in and you'd leave in the middle. And but once Mr. Hitchcock didn't allow that, and so it became this. Now, of course, that's the way they show it, but that was very rare and innovative and actually perturbing to most people until it became it caught on, so that just enhanced the excitement.
The character that Anthony Perkins plays in the film, Norman Bates, has got to be one of the more memorable roles ever. What was it like to work with him?
Well, he is just a wonderful, gifted actor. He brought so many layers, so many facets to the character of Norman Bates. Instead of just being sort of blatantly evil, he allowed. I mean, he was vulnerable. He was appealing. He was. You wanted to even protect him. I mean, he was all of these things, and then you would see the flash of the weird or the crazy come in, and then he'd go back again. I mean, he was brilliant, and the fun of working with someone like that is that you bring to the scene what me, Janet, as Marion Crane, knew pretty much what I thought Marion would be thinking and doing and how she would be reacting. But then you get in the scene and you get something from Anthony Perkins' portrayal of Norman, which sparks an even deeper reaction from you, and then what you say sparks him, and that's the give and take and the wonderful excitement of performing.
And throughout the film, Norman Bates chews on his candy corn.
Right, which was Tony's idea.
That was very spooky.
Yeah, that was a very, I thought, an interesting kind of fixation that he has.
The shower scene, that famous shower scene, it took 7 days to film. What was that like?
Well, it was wet. it took so long because even though the shot, the angle may only appear 2 or 3 seconds, but the fact that there were so many angles that they each took took a long time to set up, even though it wasn't used for a long length of time. So because there were so many angles, which helped in the editing. That's how you got that wonderful flash editing, you know, the quick shots. And so each shot took a long time to set up.
It must have gotten awfully cold and miserable out
there. Yeah, it wasn't cold because he was very careful to keep the water at a comfortable temperature. But it just got, it got pretty tired of being wet all the time. And But it was, you know, he was very thoughtful, there was always the Terry Robe waiting when at the end of each shot.
You also, in the film, you're briefly in the film, but you make an incredible impact as a character. How did you get cast in this role? How did he pick you?
Well, I don't know what prompted him. Perhaps having seen Touch of Evil, I really don't know. I mean, we knew each other socially, so he had seen me, and he'd obviously seen work that I'd done. He sent me the novel, Psycho, by Robert Bloch. A package was delivered from MCA, my agents, and it was the novel, and with a note from Mr. Hitchcock saying, "Dear Janet, please consider the role of Mary." That was the name of the novel. Of course, the characters will be, changed in the script itself, but, here's the novel. And so I don't know what prompted him, but that was how it came to me. And so I just read it immediately and picked up the phone and said yes.
My guest is Janet Leigh. When you wrote Psycho, behind the scenes of the classic thriller, you watched the film a number of times, and you kept seeing new things in the film, things you hadn't noticed before.
It's true. Mr. Hitchcock had this ability. It was almost like a challenge that he presented so many, like Anthony's character, Norman, what Anthony brought to Norman, Mr. Hitchcock did with his movies, because he would throw these clues out to you and at your leisure, when you were able to strip away this one, you'd then see an undertone of something, and then you'd strip another layer and you'd see something else. I, in writing, doing the research for the book, I ran it, 20, 30 times. And I still saw things that I had not truly noticed before. And it was amazing to me that he could have done this.
Mr. Hitchcock paid extremely close attention even to the most minute of details. He also has a lot of symbolism in the film. What are some of those little itty-bitty details that he scrutinized?
Well, it was to the point of the color of Marion's underwear. For instance, in the opening scene, it was a white bra and a white half slip. And after she has stolen the money, when she's dressing to go away and run away, it's a black bra and a black half slip.
Suddenly, she's become evil.
Yeah. Again, showing what she, does throughout the film, the split personality in all of us. I mean, all of us have the good and evil degree.
The Manchurian Candidate, another film that you were featured in with Frank Sinatra, came out, was it shortly after Psycho?
That was out, Psycho was released in 1960. And Manchurian Candidate was released in 62, I think.
This film was out for about a year, and then it was pulled from release for a long time. Why was that?
Well, because of the tragedy of the assassination of President Kennedy. And as you know, the Manchurian Candidate deals with a planned assassination, and it was just too close to home.
And now, in retrospect, after the film has been re-released, it really stands up as one of the great films of all time.
Oh, it was way ahead of its time. For me, it was such an odd, I don't want to say coincidence, that's too small of a word, but just the whole series of events. I read the book, Manchurian Candidate, on a plane on the way back to the inaugural gala given the night before the inauguration of President Kennedy. And I became so angry at the book. I just threw it in the aisle. I just was furious at the book. And when I think about it, I did not know at that time that Frank Sinatra, who had chartered the plane for all of us to go back to the D.C. for the gala, I did not know that he would buy the rights to the book. I did not know that I would be in it, and I obviously did not know that President Kennedy would be the target and, you know, the victim of an assassin's bullet. And it's more than I can, you know, can almost talk about, because it's such a series of weird events.
A very haunting coincidence.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. To this day.
How has your participation in the film Psycho affected your life?
Oh, golly. In a lot of ways. One very obvious way is that I don't take showers. But the fact of being associated with the picture that has had the impact that Psycho has and has lasted this long, and the impact having remained as strong, has been a quite remarkable thing for me. We're very fortunate, I think, since our business is to create images. And, creating images is our business, and the fact that this image has lasted for 35 years in people's minds is quite a tribute to the man who made it, to the picture itself, and for me personally.
There's almost a cult that has developed around the film.
Well, Psycho has become, it's part of our vocabulary. It's part of our culture, really. It's just an accepted. If you just hear in advertisements, you can hear it, and you immediately know they're doing the music from Psycho, and you immediately have an image, and in 2 seconds you don't have to do any more. You know, it's there.
Janet Leigh, your daughters have become well known in their own right as actresses. Did you encourage them or discourage them from doing that?
I did neither one. I neither encouraged nor discouraged because I don't think a parent should do that. I mean, a career has to be chosen by the young person themselves. I did ask that Jamie, especially, who wanted to start earlier, and I asked that she wait until she finished high school at least, and to be a kid as long as she could be, and not to take that responsibility put herself in the front line, so to speak, too early. And she accepted that, and she said that was fine, and that was the only thing that I asked. I tried to explain that there are a lot of facets to this business. You have rejection. There are demands made on your time and a certain giving up of some of your privacy. All of these things that can be drawbacks. But if you understand this, it's also the most wonderful business in the world. So. You know, I just tried to outline the good and the bad parts.
According to the book Psycho, Behind the Scenes of the Classic Thriller, neither of your daughters has seen Psycho all the way through. Is that true? They've never seen the whole film?
The children?
Uh-huh.
Well, I think, now I don't think at the time that the book was written that they did, no.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I think that it was just too... it was a little hard for them to accept, and I understand that.
Watching mother get stabbed.
Exactly.
That would be tough. Well, we really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us here at WYSO. Janet Leigh has been my guest. Janet Leigh has 2 books that have come out this year, Psycho, Behind the Scenes of the Classic Thriller, and a novel called House of Destiny. Can you give us just a quick little snapshot of the plot on House of Destiny?
House of Destiny, the 3-generation saga that starts with, you know, the story of the patriarch who comes from the old country to the new world, and the second generation goes to Hollywood, and through my characters you see the growth of Hollywood, you see the experiences of Hollywood, you see behind the scenes, like in Psycho, behind the scenes of the classic thriller, where you see sort of behind the scenes of Hollywood in the novel, and it's full of all the stuff that families are full of, you know, passion, adventure, greed, jealousy, everything. It encompasses what life is.
Well, I enjoyed,
and especially life in Hollywood.
I enjoyed both books.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your time, Janet Lee.
Well, I thank you for a wonderful talk.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 1995 interview with the late Janet Lee. Janet Lee had a long career as a movie star. She died on October 3rd, 2004. According to Wikipedia, during her final year of high school, at age 15, Lee married 18-year-old John Kenneth Carlisle in Reno, Nevada, on August 1st, 1942. The marriage was annulled 4 months later. While a student at the College of the Pacific, Lee met Stanley Reams, a U.S. Navy sailor who was enrolled at a nearby V-12 program. They married on October 5, 1945, when she was 18. That marriage, however, was also short-lived. They divorced 2 years later. On June 4, 1951, she married the actor Tony Curtis in a private ceremony in Greenwich, Connecticut. The couple had two children, Kelly and Jamie Lee, who both subsequently became actresses. Lee and Curtis's marriage was widely publicized in the media and a frequent topic in gossip columns and film tabloids. In 1962, Curtis had divorce papers served to Lee on the set of The Manchurian Candidate. Lee would later comment that their divorce was a result of outside problems, which included the death of Curtis's father. On September 15, 1962, shortly after her divorce from Curtis was finalized, Lee married stockbroker Robert Brandt in a private ceremony in Las Vegas. She remained married to Brandt for 42 years until her death in 2004. Janet Lee was a lifelong Democrat and appeared alongside Tony Curtis at the 1960 Democratic National Convention in support of John F. Kennedy. What a pleasure it was to talk to Janet Lee about her career and about the making of the movie Psycho. We have one more segment coming up on the Best of the Book Nook, and a real treat for you coming up in this final segment, an excerpt from my 2003 interview with Eric Larson as we talked about his book, which was a huge bestseller, called The Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America, right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. We began with my 1995 interview with Janet Lee talking about Psycho, behind the scenes of the classic thriller. And we're going to give you a little treat in this last segment. Back in 2003, I interviewed Eric Larson for a book called The Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America. This book was on the bestseller list for several years after it came out, and it still sells very well in paperback all these years later, 15 years after it was published. Let's revisit a segment from that interview with Eric Larson talking about what happened in Chicago. This was recorded back in 2003.
One thing I'd like to say about these side stories is that, you know, to some extent, what I live for as a writer is these side stories. I mean, the main narratives, the serial killer and the architect, are very important, very powerful stories. But to me, what they most offered was an opportunity to talk about all the marvelous things that happened in this era that came out of the fair. I mean, like the American public was introduced here for the first time at the fair to Cracker Jack, to shredded wheat, which was dismissed initially as a shredded doormat, to Aunt Jemima's pancakes, which I'm told were initially marketed as, are you ready for this, slave in a box. And even there's this other charm. I think this is one of the most charming stories, and I will give this away because I think it's just very cute. But there was another character who turned up at the fair, Saul Bloom, who at the time was an impresario from San Francisco, who was put in charge of the fun and games part of the World's Fair. He was also largely responsible for introducing America to the belly dance because there were belly dancers at this fair. And so in order to help the press understand exactly what a belly dance was, he set up a sort of a press conference. He's bringing a belly dancer to this press conference. And he expected that there would be some source of music, like an orchestra, to accompany the dancer. But what he found was one lone pianist and a piano. And the piano player had no sense of what kind of music might accompany a belly dance. So Saul Bloom, on the spot, composed a little ditty, gave it to the pianist, and he worked it into a longer thing, and that's what he played for the belly dance. And this song, I think everybody will recognize, and I will actually try to hum it for you now, if you can stand it. It goes like this. Now, how many times have you heard that in your life? And that came from Saul Bloom at the World's Fair of 1893. I just love those details. That's the best stuff.
I think I first saw that in a cartoon. I was probably 2 or 3 years old.
I think actually I first saw it in probably one of the Mel Blanc cartoons, uh-huh. Like a Bugs Bunny or something. Mm-hmm. You know, and I vaguely have this image of a snake coming out of a basket. That's my feeling.
Uh-huh. And, of course, he didn't bother to copyright this little thing he hummed.
To his eternal regret, he didn't copyright the little thing, and he estimated that he had lost millions of dollars in revenue by failing to copyright the thing.
Well, fortunately, he was a guy who understood that going through a fortune wasn't that big of a deal as long as you had a good time doing it.
That was his ethos, yeah. He was an irrepressible character.
Which brings me to Buffalo Bill, who's also part of the story.
Yeah, and Buffalo Bill, that was another thing about reading about the World's Fair when I was doing my preliminary research. I mean, Buffalo Bill has always been one of my favorite characters in history. I mean, I've never felt able to do a book about him for a variety of reasons, but you know, he was one of the most charismatic personalities of that era. And he had this traveling Wild West show in which, he'd recreate Custer's Last Stand. He'd have, Indians who used to fight the cavalry, to the death would be working side by side as actors with the soldiers they once fought. You know, they'd be playing cards on the train. And so, sure enough, Buffalo Bill turned up at this fair as well and actually almost upstaged the fair at one point. But he, too, is just this marvelous character. I mean, everybody turned up at this fair. The more, even having finished the research, I'm still hearing routinely from people about stories that I would love to have stuck into the book, even if just in the notes at the back. For example, I just discovered a couple of weeks ago when I was just kind of mindlessly surfing the net that a particular train engineer turned up at the World's Fair to help shuttle people to and from Chicago because there were so many people riding the trains, they needed more engineers. And this engineer was Casey Jones, before his catastrophic accident, of course. But there he was. Even he was there.
Well, I think a novel could be written by some enterprising writer just about Mark Twain's time in Chicago during the World's Fair, but that's a different book. The book is The Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair that Changed America. We, I think, need to hear about another event as people in our time who don't understand the point of the Columbian Exposition. I think we need to look a little bit further back at Paris to really understand the dynamic operating here.
Yeah, a number of things were happening, first of all, in this period. Number one, regardless of whether there was a Paris fair beforehand or not, this was the heyday of fairs because it was the heyday of community. I mean, people sought each other out in public places, unlike today. But what happened was in 1888, there was the Paris Universal Exposition, which the United States had sort of half-heartedly attended, and the exhibits were sort of slipshod and so forth. Lo and behold, the French pulled out all stops and just absolutely overwhelmed us, the United States, and virtually every other country with their, the glories of their art, of their manufacturing, and above all of their engineering manifested in the Eiffel Tower, which was built for the Paris Exposition. This was a hard thing for the U.S. to take. I mean, it was our own damn fault for not making a better showing, at the World's Fair of 1888. So one of the goals of having a fair in 18 it was originally supposed to be 1892, the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of America, but even those crafting the legislation realized that there's just no way a fair could be opened in time. So it was set to open on May 1st, 1893. But one of the goals from the outset on a national level was that the fair had to be at least one-third larger than the Paris Exposition, and also that something had to be found to out-Eiffel Eiffel. That was the rallying cry. Mm. Had to out-Eiffel Eiffel. And it was actually Burnham who really got fed up. He was delighted by the performance of America's architects in coming up with ideas for the World's Fair of 1893. But he was totally disappointed in America's civil engineering community. And at one point actually issued this scathing challenge to the engineers of America, saying essentially, why can't you guys come up with something that would equal what the architects have come up with? Which led to another interesting element of the book that it also puts me in an area that I'm really not sure I want to talk about, but it's a delightful thing. But anyway, there was that desire to absolutely supersede the Paris Fair. But then Chicago had an agenda here. Chicago had always felt like a second-class city compared to New York, and arguably still feels that way today. But back in the 1890s, when Chicago was really feeling its muscles, had grown so fast and was this big, burly, smoky, mercantile financial capital, it felt a little insecure about its artistic prowess, its refinement. And so it saw the fair also as a way of making Chicago seem the equal of Paris, London, and above all, the equal of New York. Mm-hmm. So there was this huge amount of enthusiasm throughout Chicago and throughout the Midwest for this World's Fair, the kind of enthusiasm you just won't see anymore in the future of America, I'm certain. And the result was this absolutely glamorous event.
And there was also that element of innocence and trust, people putting themselves at the mercy of untested devices, people coming in from the heartland of America to the big city, young women looking for work.
Right, right. That's one of the interesting places where the fair and the serial killer kind of begin to come together, because one of the things that the killer, Dr. Holmes, took advantage of, he took advantage of the forces that were shaping America at this time, among them easy transportation, easy communication, and above all, the fact that young women were on their own really for the first time in American history. That is, they were able to leave their small towns and travel to the big city unescorted really for the first time. They were able to live alone. They were able to have careers. And he took advantage of this because these were exceptionally vulnerable people. He also took advantage of another, you talk about innocence and of the age. There was another aspect, credit in terms of financial endeavors and also in terms of buying products on credit and so forth. This was it wasn't so much a new concept, but easy credit was for the first time available. And Holmes, being a full-service psychopath, also took advantage of that to con just about everybody out of everything you can imagine, even bicycles. I mean, he was a bicycle fanatic, and was actually apparently was riding his bicycle through the fairgrounds as it was under construction. If you can kind of imagine the old Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, raindrops keep falling on my head, but only in a minor chord. You get a sense of Holmes riding this bike through the south side of Chicago. So he took advantage of all these forces that were coming to bear on the country.
He took advantage of these innocent people coming in for the fair. He took advantage of credit, easy credit. He took advantage of the insurance companies.
Oh, yes.
And this ultimately finally caught up with him, but the guy is in Chicago doing what he's doing, and he's so charming. He's so amazingly charming. Everyone that he meets just falls for this guy. Let's talk about his personality. Who was this guy?
Yeah, that was an interesting aspect of his character, and it perplexed me at first as I was doing the research. I just couldn't understand, how did this guy get away with this stuff? I mean, he was not caught or even detected during the World's Fair. He was brought to justice about 2 years afterwards, really by accident, by a series of sort of fluky events that ultimately unsettled him in the midst of arguably his darkest miracle, if you will, his most cruel exploit in terms of, you know, killing. So I was perplexed by this guy because obviously, you know, they didn't have psychiatrists or FBI profilers who would spend days debriefing him and trying to figure out what made him tick or not tick. So actually, when I finished the first draft of the manuscript, I gave a copy to a forensic psychiatrist in Seattle to see if he could help me figure out what this guy was all about. So he read the book, and then we had a very nice, if creepy, breakfast talking about what this was all about. And it was he who concluded from, you know, the fairly lush evidence that I was able to turn up that this guy was what would be described as a full-blown psychopath. I mean, that's what psychiatrists will still say in private, although the official diagnosis today would be somebody who is suffering from antisocial personality disorder, fairly boring term that would have made Hitchcock, I think, very unhappy, you know, psycho and so forth. But talking about what a psychopath is and how they behave, it became very clear that, yes, indeed, that is what Holmes was. And the thing about psychopaths, psychopaths were very poorly understood, really, until about the 1950s, mainly because they don't seem to be insane at first encounter, or even at second or third encounter. You know, they're just hyper charming; they seem hyper intelligent. The whole thing. It's only after you've been with them for a prolonged period of time, as one particular psychiatrist wrote after extensive study, that you realize, as he put it, and I love this, as he put it, that they aren't human. Which is very creepy, you know. And what he meant was there was no moral core, nothing there. It's just an emptiness beyond the superficial charm. And that is the particularly creepy thing about this guy. I mean, as I was doing my research, I found myself growing more and more repulsed by this guy. I mean, usually, I've been an investigative reporter in the past, and any time I wrote about a ne'er-do-well, there was always something charming about them, you know. But not this guy. It's just this, the way I would best describe it is as a sort of, my own reaction to him was a sort of moral ennui. Like, I'm just tired of this guy. Like, you know, which was odd, because that's true, that there was just this emptiness in this guy.
I think we need to talk about his business and his building. Mm-hmm. At least as much as you're comfortable discussing that.
No, I don't mind talking about that. The action in the book really starts getting going after we get a sense of what's happening in this building. But you know what he did was he'd come to Chicago in 1886 and almost immediately upon arrival, fleeced an old woman out of her drugstore. I mean, you know, square one, right? Step one: how to settle in Chicago for a psychopath. And then he began building on an adjacent plot of land. He acquired this plot of land from a woman in New York, no doubt conning her as well. And on this land, he began building a three-story structure. When he discovered that the fair, Miracle of Miracles, was going to be built in Jackson Park, due east of where he was building this hotel, this building, he began making plans and designing a World's Fair hotel, a way to transform it into a hotel that ideally would lodge these young women who are on their own for the first time and who are drawn to the fair and need a cheap place to stay. And here is Holmes with his World's Fair hotel, just a brief streetcar ride away. But the thing that made this hotel a little bit unique and sort of separates it from the Four Seasons and the Fairmounts and so forth were things like a crematorium in the basement, dissection table, lime pits, and also even a greased chute for the easy transfer of bodies from the third floor to the basement. He was not a nice guy. Not your warmest innkeeper, if you know what I mean.
Wow. The Devil in the White City. Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair that Changed America. I was reading this book last night. I just kept turning the pages and going, I love this. You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. That was Eric Larson talking about The Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair that Changed America, recorded 15 years ago. And we began with the late Janet Leigh, recorded in 1995, her book Psycho, behind the scenes of the classic thriller. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.